Coffee Sketch Podcast is our take on the intersection of old tech and new tech, the space between the traditional practice of the hand-drawn sketch that has been performed by architects and designers for centuries, and the modern-day use of the hashtag as a representation of a sentiment or a movement. Each week we plan to deliver a new pod about our ideas, sketches, and what's going on in our daily lives as we pursue our love of architecture, design, and sharing this knowledge with the next generation. I'm Kurt, and I'm in Flint.
And I'm Jamie, and I'm in Austin.
Hey, Jamie. Is that loud enough for you?
I'm here. Is this thing on? Tap, tap, tap.
Thanks for describing the noise it would make if you hit the microphone and not actually hitting the microphone.
Yeah.
So that we would have to redo the intro.
I'm getting used to this now. I mean, we're one take. I mean, how many episodes are we in now?
This makes 63.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And for those that have not seen the Twitter tweet, we just passed 3,000 downloads. And I mean, I think that's a high number. So I'm going to celebrate. You know, we got a little boost. What do you call it? A pep talk email from our content host that said, "Woohoo! You made 3,000." So,
you realize that's probably a bot, right?
Automated. Well, you know, everything's automated, but yeah. I still feel good.
Okay.
AI has made me feel good.
You had an AI pep talk, and in this Zoom life, you feel really, really good about it. So.
That's right.
But no, I like the numbers. We got some nice, congratulatory messages from some folks, and it is fun that I'm glad that there's quite a number of people who are seem to be enjoying what we've been talking about. We're having fun doing it, and I seem to have kind of gotten out of my doldrums with some sketches at least partially of late. So I'm working on it.
Yeah. There are quite a few that we have a super fresh one today, but I know I've seen on Instagram there's quite a few juicy ones that we can talk about.
So
in the event there could be another.
In the event there's another,
coffee sketch block.
Yeah. So.
But there won't be.
No. Well, maybe. But So I also have heard that a care package arrived.
Not a day too soon. I was on my last coffee bean, literally, and I was surprised not just with one bag of Little City coffee, but two bags and a sticker and a nice note from my co-host. Which I have right here, and I'm going to read it. It says, "For my Coffee Sketch Podcast co-host, smiley face."
There you go.
These are not tears running down my face. It's just sweat.
It's just sweat, because I know we've talked about the heat. We've done our weather reports in other episodes of late. So which of the two bags have you decided to bust open and share with the fam there?
So the Little City, and I tweeted, and they responded really quickly. So I really appreciate that Little City.
Yeah, I mean their social media game is pretty on point. I have to say, I like that.
Yeah, and they even gave you a thank you as a, they said that was a nice gesture, Jamie, to send your friend some coffee. But the two kinds is one's the Grackle, which I think you've mentioned before, Grackle.
That it's the ever-present bird, like in Austin, and then for me it's also that sort of that tie to it's actually, so here we go, we're gonna go into like the peel back the curtain into our lives. So Jason, who's been a guest on the show, we talked about the Twin Peaks, which I'll get to. I will mention one more time in this episode. But Jason and I are good friends. We've known each other since high school. And Jason is not into the sports ball quite the way you and I talked the baseball a little while ago. But Jason does like it to some degree. We've always teased him about it. And what was interesting though is Jason does have a mind for statistics and numbers and you know the intrigue of the game, the strategy. And so you know, enter fantasy football and Jason is all over it. I mean, fantasy sports, Jason is, you know, he's a pro. But all of his fantasy football teams all have Grackle in it as some. So whenever I hear it, I always think of him and his fantasy football teams. But more importantly, though, the supporter group for the new MLS franchise, the Austin FC, the first supporter group is the Austin Anthem. And they, you know, quite rightly adopted the Grackle as their logo and symbol. Somebody had to do it. Yeah. And so the coffee is definitely akin to the city for sure.
So I actually did not open that first. I opened the Congress Avenue blend or roast. And what caught my eye is the flavor notes that they said were caramel and chocolate, and I forget the other one. I don't have the bag in front of me, but it's really the caramel. You know, I couldn't resist. And you know, when you grind them up, and I use a French press, and I try and keep things clean in my French press, and so I grind them up each morning, and you can really taste it, and it's super. It's just they're some of the best sentimental. It's not just sentimental. Some of the best beans I've had in a long time.
We will hang out soon. We will hang out soon. We will all get past this Zoom life. You know, it's going to happen. I know it will.
Yeah. No problem. I appreciate it, and I will now return the favor with some local Flint vibes, and get that over to you.
Nice.
First taste.
Nice.
Yes. Thanks again. And so one other, well, what about you? I guess, and you know what I'm drinking. What are you drinking?
Well, so I actually, as I was thinking about, you know, coffee care packages and whatnot, and I did mention this to you when I did discover it, because it was around that same time. But there is a company, and now I can't even think of the name of the company, but they are making a Twin Peaks roast. And so for the 30th anniversary of Twin Peaks and all that stuff. So I, you know, we've been watching that and getting Kirk kind of caught up on the series, which is pretty great. And Jason's been participating as well. But so I indulged and decided to, you know, give myself a little gift. And, yeah. So
nice.
I got some beans too. So
cool. I remember I saw it. Well, actually, you took a picture of it. Let's see if I can find it. Well, but I don't want to delay. I think I can't find it. But anyway, one other surprise, and since we don't really talk to our listeners too much, I snuck in there some different music on the past two episodes, and my brother, who's done all our music to date, has gifted us, and he gave us a little gift of some new music for the podcast. And I actually, there was two tunes. And what I decided to do was use both of them one for each episode, so the intro and outro. But then the one I picked for the neuroscience episode was more specifically chosen over the other one of the new songs, because it had this interesting tone to it that I thought gave it some connection to the concept or our discussion of neuroscience. And so, I'm not a great editor of our audio. I try and do as good as I can, but I tried to sneak in a little sound bite in the middle. But to my brother, who's a little more tuned up for that, he said, that's kind of a random piece of... So, that's his nice way of saying, like, do better.
He's like, hey,
blend, the fade in there.
Yeah, he's like, hey, twin bro, let's work on that. So, yeah, no, he's been great. I'm glad you were able to kind of mix those up. Knowing those were coming, it was sort of exciting to kind of re-listen to things after your edit. And I'm glad that we got to have that. And I think it'd be kind of fun to have him back on and maybe do a little bit more where we, intersperse a few more tracks that he's been working on. I know he's been doing a lot of late, and experimenting. So
that's true. Yeah. I mean, and it's really sounding good too. Like, I was just talking to him the other day about how it's starting to sound like he's getting a sound, or, how musicians find like their tone or their voice in their music. It's starting to coalesce, I think, with all of his, because he's done a lot of soundscape exploration, experimentation, things like that, and it's starting to refine itself into pretty cool sound.
I don't know if it's that he's evolving, or if it's just more of this COVID time, for all of us creatives, some of it works out and some of it doesn't, but we're not going to go there. I'm not going to touch that subject anymore. So we will transition, though, because you and I both, as we're recording this, not what, 2 hours ago? Is that right? About right? Yeah. That's right. So we were treated to something that we had been teasing out on Twitter, or at least promoting on Twitter. But AIA Austin and the Austin Architectural Foundation were hosting a live architectural history lecture by one of our local members here in Austin, who's also a faculty member at the University of Texas Architecture School. And he was introducing folks, including myself, because I've only seen, and he mentioned it sort of in the lead up to, during his talk, but, I had only seen one photo of this particular building and from the exterior, just as he was sort of describing it. And because it's one we'll certainly talk about here, but it was, it's architecture that hasn't been seen that should be. And so he apparently has been working on this for a little bit of time now with others on developing a book, a monograph in the architecture speak of a project in Houston, Texas. And I'll let you talk about it a little bit and talk about the lecture, but sure. This is sort of us hearkening back to episode 41. So earlier this spring,
wait, episode 42.
No, it's 41.
It's 41.
It's 41. Oh,
you did that on purpose. You had me write down 42.
Did I?
I thought so. Well, anyway, I don't want to
I think I tweeted 42 and I meant 41 and then didn't realize it till afterwards. So well, anyhow,
we're in the vicinity, and if people give it a listen somewhere back in there, they'll find out.
They'll find us talking about somebody everybody should know. I mean, especially in sort of Texas architecture history, but I think in architectural history for the U.S. certainly as well, because his career spans many decades and has quite a few little interesting tidbits to it. But John Saunders Chase Jr., who we spoke about in that episode at length, was the subject of this lecture that both of us were able to attend today. So what'd you think?
Yeah, it was very cool. Yeah, that was really cool and a nicely done program. So shout out to AIA Austin and for providing a CEU learning unit for that webinar or a Zoom webinar, because we were teasing about getting our Zoom life on, and I feel like the past 2 days for me have been full of Zooms. So anyway, I think for everybody,
there's an element of that, whether you're going out and still returning to your office or wherever you're working, or if you're working from home, everybody's has an element of this sort of digital realm that we're all we're all new about, but we're definitely finding ourselves in certainly uncharted territory. And if you've got kids, there's a lot of things about schools right now and what we experienced sort of at the end of last semester. It's definitely on everybody's mind, for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, I shouldn't even complain about Zooms at this point, but we're lucky we have the technology. So the presenter, David Heyman, he's a fellow, FAIA, was presenting on John Saunders Chase FAIA, which here's the thing, right? He's deceased now, but the first African-American registered architect in Texas, in the state of Texas. And so what was presented was his primarily focused on his personal residence. So John Saunders Chase house that he designed for himself and his family in 1959, as it says here in the email from AI Austin. And so in preparation for our conversation right now, I was Googling his name plus, the words residence or home or house. And you find only things you can find on images right now are the sketches that were used for this promotion from AI Austin and David Heyman's book. And it's a shame that, the first registered architect, African-American registered architect in Texas, and you can't find a bulk of information out there for, the work too is amazing. So the presentation was cool.
Let's not even get to the house yet. Let's just stay there just for a second. Is that, and David Heyman, he introed it this way, and I wish he had spent just maybe another minute, maybe two, on it, because I think it's something that maybe is lost on some listeners to it, not all, for sure, but is that here we are, Mr. Chase, who. Like I mentioned when we did talk about him, earlier this year, is, I was lucky to meet him, and have some conversations with him. And I'm not going to go into that, but, he graduated from the University of Texas. He's they're literally their first, Black architect, graduate. And, and this is the 1950s. And, so he's the first Black architect licensed in the state of Texas. He's also the first Black architect who is ever a member of the Texas Society of Architects. You know, and TSA and Texas Society of Architects is probably, I mean, they're not the biggest, but, you know, of the states, you know, there's, you know, we're talking New York, California, and Texas are probably the three biggest states, you know, amongst, mm-hmm. you know, the national organization. And, you know, and I will say this, you know, and I'm going to say it on this podcast, and I've said it, you know, to people, and I've written it. We have a Lifetime Achievement Award here in Texas, and it's similar to the AI Gold Medal that they give away nationally. And I'm sure that many, many states have similar awards. In Texas, it's also a medal, and it's not, they don't refer to it as their gold medal. They refer to it as their Pitts Medal, you know, for a former president who was sort of groundbreaking and legendary within the Texas Society of Architects. And so they refer to it as the Pitts Medal or the Lifetime Achievement Award, you know, here more in more recent years. But they don't give it posthumously. Thank you.
Posthumously, right.
Posthumously. Thank you. Really? So they don't give it that way. It's this weird stipulation on their awards program, and I think it's, you know, I think it's a failing, you know, especially in cases like this, because just as you say, is, you know, here's some work that you're familiar, you know, becoming more familiar with, that I was familiar with to a certain extent, you know, and we'll talk about the house here in a second, but you know, it's overlooked. You know, here's a man who, you know, is a series of firsts in his career. And beyond that, you know, there's some other things that I think are sort of, I've related to other folks as sort of interesting anecdotes, but it's ones that are equally poignant is, you know, and Heyman mentions this very briefly in the beginning is, and then he doesn't say the second part of it is President Carter, you know, appointed John Chase to a commission that eventually selected Maya Lin as the winning entry in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And, you know, I mean, you know, that, you know, and that time period and that debate and all those things associated with it. I mean, that's pretty big architecture history and American history for that matter. But, you know, he also was one of the founding members of NOMA, eventually became their president, you know, and then, you know, so there's all these other things that it, you know, it's not that he was a really great architect and that alone, you know, that's evident by the work and we're going to talk about it, but his career and the breadth of his career and the service and all the other things that would really, in my opinion, and probably the opinion of many others, necessitate somebody being recognized for their career contributions over a lifetime is, you know, I don't know how much more you have to do. I don't care if that's, you know, some weird stipulation in the fine print of that award, but, you know, let's fix it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, is there any chatter amongst the Texas Society to revisit that rule or policy on that? That there should be some resolution.
I'll just say there should be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting, I don't know too many places that have that kind of, especially amongst chapters of the AIA, you know, across the country.
Right.
I don't know. I would have to look at the bylaws for AI Michigan, but I gotta imagine that's not true because they recently gave, I want to say 2 years ago, they gave, I don't think it was, we have a gold medal for Michigan. There was a similar, the gold medal is kind of the number one, you know, award. And then there's quite a few kind of similar to national where they have like the Topaz and all the various named awards. I can't remember them all right now. And we did give one to a African American architect from Michigan, who hit, it was posthumous, and his son, who is quite a senior citizen at this point now, is was there to receive the award. So at least, you know, there was that. It was very cool and similar. And we don't, yeah, I'm going to go off track, because maybe what I'll do is I'll grab some stuff for another episode to talk about Margaret from Michigan here.
Yeah, no, that'd be good
in the future. But it, as far as time frame and practice of architecture, it's, there's a lot of parallel in the sort of the pioneering of you know, being licensed Black architects in the country. So
well, I mean, and not just that, but I mean, if you think about, like, you know, both of us have talked about your USC Trojan fellow alum.
Right.
You know, and that was a, you know, you know, at the same time, it was an award that was, you know, long overdue. So I think that it's something that's, it's certainly something that I think is, you know, I have to bring it up. I have to say it. And I'll just leave it at that. But the lecture, you know, was really, really focused on his house, which I was particularly excited about. Because, you know, just as you were, you know, saying, is it's something that is really hasn't been documented, you know, and there really isn't a lot of photographs or drawings that are readily available, you know, to see that kind of, you know, see that part of his portfolio. And I think that that's, you know, hopefully this lecture and this book are, you know, kind of, you know, change that a little bit. But, mm-hmm. you know, I was excited to just sort of see it. And with that, you know, I was equally inspired to, while I was seeing some of these amazing drawings that were generated for the book, I started sketching. So.
Mm-hmm. And so what we're looking at, sorry, that was a awkward, positive affirmation there, but so your sketch for today, sorry, I'm getting a little heat stroke over here. The sketch of today is actually really neat, side by side. So what the cool thing about this house, well, one of the many cool things, and I'll try and get into my points. Well, one is your cool sketch that it's a mid-century courtyard house. So, you know, you're in the southern part of the United States, so you have really nice, you know, year-round seasons, and you can kind of pull off this kind of architecture where you have a very kind of case study house style home design that has the an inner courtyard, and the side by side is that this courtyard space was transformed by Chase himself. I think you said 10 years later.
About 10 years later, I didn't catch the exact date, you know, during the lecture, but I, in part of them talking about the house and the transformation, they were interviewing the family quite a bit. And one of the things they sort of alluded to was, well, as the kids kind of grew up, you know, we needed to rethink some of the spaces that we needed, and we wanted a game room and we wanted a home office. And, though the kids, when they were younger, really used the courtyard in a certain way, we wanted to transform it, you know, kind of as the family was, you know, growing older. And so, you know, it's one thing for an architect, and Heyman kind of made this point, is it's one thing for an architect to design their own home. Yeah. You know, that's a big first step. Right. And sort of a dream for a lot of us, you know, but along those same lines, it's, you know, not just to design your own home, but, you know, in this particular, you know, residence and then to redesign it and to is, you know, the first move of designing it was a very, very progressive, decidedly modern aesthetic and plan and kind of formal principles, and we'll probably talk about it here a little bit more, but then the renovation is equally so, you know, about 10 years or so later. So I was really enthralled by it all and tried to capture some of the, they kept coming back to during the talk, this courtyard space and how it transformed over time. And so I was able to, I started drawing one aspect of it, and then they started doing the side by side, and I was like, oh, I'm going to keep drawing. So,
well, I mean, I picked it up really quickly once when you sent me the sketch, as we said, hot off the press. At the beginning of this, because it rendered, you know, you've rendered it so well. And so the other point I was going to make about the house, and what it was nice about the presentation, was the comparison to other case study or mid-century architects like Eichler in the West, so in California, and Anshin and Allen, which is a firm that still exists today in LA, which I remember from my time in LA as a student and working, but they go by a different name now, but you know, it sort of evolved. But that firm still exists, Anshin and Allen, one of the older firms in LA. And basically these, you know, this sort of case study, like, and John and Tenza, you know, commissioned the case study houses. It's hard to try to explain it in a nutshell, but he basically commissioned a bunch of youngish, but sort of up and coming architects at the time to design some modern houses that kind of challenge or present a new way of thinking about how people lived in the mid-century, which is, you know, the post-war era. And so you're trying to move past those traditional home types and think about, you know, modern ways of living with modern equipment and things like that. And John Saunders was not a part of the case study program, but his house is exemplary of what that program kind of inspired. His house is a perfect example of what would be a case study type house. And actually, what Heyman did in the presentation was compared it side by side with the Anshin and Allen design of Fort Eichler, I think, at the time. So it was a two, you know, John, the Chase house and this other house for Eichler, a builder in California. And, you know, striking comparisons in their use of a courtyard and similarities, but I think the nuance in John Chase's had a lot more technical ingenuity and sequence of movement through the house from the front door into the courtyard, into the more formal front door at the opposite end of the courtyard, you know, this progression through the space.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so, I think that sequence of spaces was really, really evident, you know, in the side by side. And at that point, you're really kind of unlocking, you know, the this whole concept of a courtyard house, or a courthouse, as Heyman kept referring to it as. Mm-hmm. But it's, I think what's also sort of interesting about it is, you know, the plan of the Chase residence, I think, you know, is it and I think they're both, you know, side by side, they're comparable size, but the expansiveness of the way that he's kind of created those spaces, he gives over a lot to the courtyard, but I think square footage wise, I think it ends up being a richer experience, you know, at least in that side by side comparison. That's just looking at two different plans. Not talking about the richness of the space, you know, in experiencing it. I just think it's that sequence of arrival and sort of interaction with the two spaces is markedly different. Also, which wasn't sort of discussed, is sort of the position of that garage. You know, it's our car culture. You know, that I think is, you know, we certainly can't jettison that, especially in, California or in Houston, Texas. So you're going to have a garage, you're going to have a place for your car, and you want to have it attached to the house, or in close proximity. So it's interesting how the two of them also sort of handle that a little bit as well, as sort of this, sense of arrival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think I liked how Chase's was done better. It was kind of pushed back.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's secondary. I mean, the car is secondary. Sort of like the private entry, versus, the public entry and sort of the sequence of space. And I think there's a sophistication and formality of the Chase residence that's not present in the other one. And then at the same time, I think it's, what's interesting too, is this sort of landscape element, is that you're introducing this courtyard. In the Eichler project, it's more about light, as more of a light well, as opposed to in Chase's, where it's more of a introduction, introducing us to the organic, inside the house. There's a living aspect to that space, and I think that's pretty exciting.
So not only did he nail it on the first go, I think even in the redesign, he nailed it again. And, in the sense, I'm talking about he produced a beautiful design both times. And I'm looking at the dates here, right? He's in school at Austin in 1950. And he finished this house in, wasn't it 1959?
That's right, yeah.
So, say it takes four to five years, like we all do now. So that's 1955. And then four or five years later, he's designing his own house.
I think he graduated in 52 or 53, because that was his graduate program.
Still relatively young and
very young. Yes, I mean, this is like at the beginning of his career for sure,
and fresh out of school, and it still stands today, right? You mentioned that his wife still lives there,
right,
in the house. So
yeah,
but it's cool. It's really exciting to have, the opportunity to design your own house early on, and he did a great job. And I really wish there was more I could pull up visually right now to kind of dig into some pictures beyond your sketches, but and then what was in the presentation. But because, luckily AI Austin recorded it, and we can go back and watch it again for some more documentation.
I think the thing about the renovation is important to note is that they effectively enclosed the courtyard. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, not to give it away, but when you look at the side-by-side sketch, you're like, oh, okay, there's this sort of trellis space and this courtyard, and there's a lot of greenery, and it's sort of the center of the home, this introduction of the organic, to the center. It's a very right kind of thing to do, and Frank Lloyd Wright, and then, like you say, he nails it on the second try too, where he, comes back and renovates the house and encloses that space, and then adds a second story to a portion of the home, and where that center court has become a double volume space now with a butterfly roof. And the upstairs public space that's created is sort of a game room mixed use space with a extra bedroom and home office off to the side. But there's this really kind of wonderful interplay between the two semi-public spaces. You have this upstairs space, that's a little bit smaller, but has this sort of activity zone. And then downstairs now, all of the spaces that were looking into or interacting with that courtyard are now opened up to it because it's all interior space. And so your bar space, your dining room space, your living room, your kitchen, all of that is sort of interacting with that courtyard that's now enclosed. And I think it's really, really evident. You sort of see this evolution of, you know, the family growing into their home. But at the same time, the architect getting a chance to sort of revisit their own design. And, you know, it was really, really remarkable to sort of see the side by side. I liked the way the presentation was done and the way it was sort of talked mm-hmm. about. And I imagine that the book is sort of in the sort of same vein, where they're very, very deliberate about the points of view to explain a particular point. And I liked the way that the drawings were rendered. I think that there was something that it felt a little bit nostalgic a bit.
Just about to say.
Yeah. Right. What'd you think about the drawings?
The drawings. I was just going to say that after you, but since you brought it up, don't take offense. Your render, the way you render drawings and your sketches, we all are major fans of, and I really love your drawings. And there's a totally different premise as far as you're doing, you know, very short time frame sketches. But but there's a cool similarity in that Chase's drawings are these nice, heavy, well, contrast black and white drawings with really, really detailed landscape. So the trees and shadows and all the features in plan view and in elevation or section or perspective are integrated with landscape. So all of that with the architecture. So, you know, it's not just drawings of buildings. But they're a lot more crisp in the sense compared to your sketches because he's, you know, they're hard.